Welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger, and our first story today, the headline reads, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Rallies Iowa Support. Campaign event serves as nominating convention for We the People Party. It's written by Caleb McAuliffe, Globe Gazette, the Des Moines Bureau, and the dateline is West Des Moines. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was formally nominated as a candidate for president in Iowa on Saturday as hundreds of his supporters gathered in West Des Moines to hear the independent candidate speak. The campaign event functioned as a nominating convention for the We the People Party, the moniker Kennedy's campaign is using in several states to achieve ballot access. Kennedy urged the people gathered at the rally to abandon the two major presidential candidates. He cast himself as a way to unite a divided American electorate and address political polarization. Neither of these presidents is capable of ending the polarization, which is also toxic and existential for our country, he said. He continued, "We don't know how it's going to end unless we take responsibility today for ending that polarization." The son of former U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy and nephew of former President John F. Kennedy, Kennedy has launched an independent presidential campaign after running an unsuccessful primary challenge to President Joe Biden. Last month, he selected Silicon Valley attorney Nicole Shanahan as his running mate. Kennedy had a career as an environmental lawyer and rose to prominence, in part promoting conspiracy theories about vaccines and public health. He took aim at pharmaceutical companies, large financial corporations, and political leaders, whom he considers part of a corrupt political system. While the We the People Party is not legally a political party in Iowa, the state allows non-party political organizations to nominate candidates for president via convention. The organization must have 500 residents present to vote for a presidential and vice presidential candidate. The campaign had 686 eligible electors sign in on Saturday, an official said. Kennedy described Republican former President Donald Trump and Democratic President Joe Biden as aligned on issues of federal spending, public health, and military action. He said the two major parties differ only on culture war issues. None of them are actually the issues that are existential for our country, he said. The issues that are important if we want to see the survival of our country, if we want to see prosperity for our children, if we want to see the moral authority of our nation restored, he said. Third-party candidates have historically fared poorly in presidential elections, but Kennedy said he believes this is the year a third-party candidate can win the election, capitalizing on voters' dissatisfaction with both Biden and Trump. Polling on Kennedy's support is spotty, but he has lodged 10% to 15% of support in some recent national polls, according to 538, while others have him in the low single digits. Biden's campaign and Democrats have begun taking measures to weaken Kennedy over concerns that he could potentially take vital votes away from the president in key battleground states. The Democratic National Committee hired a team of lawyers to monitor Kennedy's ballot access efforts, USA reported today. Trump has suggested Kennedy would be a boost to his electoral chances and take votes away from Biden, saying in a Truth Social post this week, Kennedy is a great for MAGA, or rather is great for MAGA. Trump's campaign has supported Kennedy's efforts to get on state ballots. Kennedy said he is confident he will get on the ballot in all 50 states. People want a candidate they believe in, that they think is going to change some things, some of the downward trends in our country, he said, and I don't think either of those candidates offers that. People don't want to vote for them. Well, Republican Party of Iowa Chair Jeff Kaufman said in a statement Friday that Kennedy was a distraction and Trump offers more solutions for Iowa voters. Kennedy is peddling his toxic conspiracy theories instead of speaking to the problems facing Americans caused by the Biden administration, Kaufman said. Iowans want solutions, not distractions. President Trump will deliver on his promises to secure the border, fix the economy, and restore America's standing across the globe, he said. Kennedy's fans at the event echoed his concerns, saying they are dissatisfied with the major political parties and hoping he can deliver a shakeup to what they see as a broken political system. Brad Young, 39, of Council Bluffs, said he supported Kennedy's environmental protection and his activism on the purported link between childhood vaccines and autism. Several students have found no casual link between several studies have found no casual link between vaccines and autism, and a 1998 study that inspired the theory was retracted. Young said he did not vote for Trump or Biden in 2020, and he would not support either of them this year, regardless of Kennedy's ballot access. It's not just a Republican or a Democrat problem. It's obviously across the board, he said. Our elected officials are maybe just a little out of touch, so it would be great to have a third party. Mark and Julia Seaton of Waukee also said they would not vote for Trump or Biden in November. The Seatons both voted for Trump in 2020 and 2016, they said, but Julia said she would not cast a vote if there was not a third-party option this year. Mark Seaton was dubious that Kennedy could get enough support to win the election this year, but he said he could set a trend for a viable third-party candidate in the future. I'm very down on the whole political system, Mark Seaton said. Hopefully, an independent candidate can become a viable candidate, and we have actually three viable candidates for president. Historically, that's the case. We're stuck with Biden and Trump running, he said. Next article on page one, Iowa High Court Justice recuses self over a fair claim. And it's written by Caleb McCullough, Des Moines, the Dateline. An Iowa Supreme Court Justice recused himself from a pending divorce case over claims he had an extramarital affair with the woman in the divorce more than a decade ago, according to court records. Iowa Supreme Court Justice Christopher McDonald granted an order to recuse himself in response to a motion filed by John Mordini, who was appealing the terms of a divorce proceeding with his ex-wife, Nikki Mordini. The case is in the Iowa Court of Appeals after John Mordini appealed the district court's decision on April 9. In the motion asking for the recusal, which was filed the same day as the appeal, John Mordini stated McDonald and Nikki Mordini, an immigration and family law attorney, were involved in an affair during the time of the marriage. The affair had a significant negative impact on the marriage and ultimately contributed to the breakdown in the bonds of matrimony, the motion says. The motion further states that Nikki Mordini met with McDonald in the summer of 2023 after she filed for divorce and discussed the fact that John Mordini knew of the affair. It would be impossible for the appellant to believe he would be given fair consideration by Justice McDonald given the aforementioned facts and events, the motion says. McDonald filed an order the same day granting the motion and recusing himself with no additional detail. Then, on April 11, he filed an amended order. The amended order again granted the recusal motion and said the recusal was based upon a personal relationship between McDonald and Nikki Mordini that occurred more than a decade ago. Steve Davis, a spokesperson for the Iowa Judicial Branch, said McDonald was unable to provide further comment. He said the Iowa Code of Judicial Conduct prevents judges, justices, and court staff from commenting on pending cases. The Code of Judicial Conduct states that justices should recuse themselves when their impartiality might be reasonably questioned, including when the judge has a personal bias or prejudice concerning party or party lawyer, among other circumstances. A lawyer representing Nikki Mordini declined to comment. John Mordini could not be reached by phone on Friday. The Polk County District Court granted a divorce between John and Nikki Mordini on March 22, about a year after Nikki Mordini initially filed for divorce. Nikki Mordini owns a law practice in Des Moines, and John Mordini is self-employed in construction. They were married in 2003. Christopher McDonald was appointed to the Supreme Court by Republican Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds in 2019. He served on the Court of Appeals from 2013 to 2019 and was a district court judge and in private practice before that. McDonald is married and has three children, according to the Iowa Supreme Court website. Court records show he was divorced in 2009. Turning to page 2, the headline reads, "All sides gained when Iran attacked Israel," written by Tia Goldenberg, an Associated Press article. Tel Aviv, Israel. The unprecedented attack by Iran on Israel early Sunday ratcheted up regional tensions, confirming long-held fears about the Israel-Hamas war spiraling into a broader conflagration. But Iran, Israel, the United States, and Hamas also walked away with some gains. And here's a look at the fallout. Israel's response could restore faith in military. More than 300 drones and missiles headed toward Israel in the early hours of Sunday, the country was able to successfully put to the test its aerial defense array, which, along with the help from allies, blocked 99% of the projectiles and prevented major damage. By contrast, Israel's military had suffered a bruising defeat at the hands of a far less equipped enemy when Hamas stormed from Gaza into Israel on October 7. That was a major blow to Israel's image as a regional military powerhouse and shattered any sense of invincibility. The response to Iran's attack could be what restores faith in the country's military, even as its forces are bogged down in Gaza, more than 6 months after Israel declared war on Hamas there. Israel has also boasted, about the coalition of forces that helped it repel the Iranian assault. It's a much-needed show of support at a time when Israel is isolated because of concerns surrounding its conduct during the war against Hamas, including a worsening humanitarian crisis and a staggering death toll in Gaza. Iran vowed repeatedly that it would respond to an apparent Israeli strike on an Iranian diplomatic compound in Damascus on April 1 that killed two generals. Sunday's assault allowed Iran to show to its citizens that it won't stand by when its assets are attacked and that it was serious when it threatened revenge. With its strike, Iran was able to exhibit its fierce firepower, instill fear in some Israelis, and disrupt the lives of many through school cancellations. But with little damage actually caused in Israel, Iran might hope that any response will be measured. Several hours after it launched the drones and missiles, Iran said the operation was over. The U.S. was a key player in repelling the assault, demonstrating to its allies around the world the power and reliability of American support. Now, as Israel mulls how and whether to respond, that alliance will be put to the test, with the Biden administration seeking to exert its leverage on Israel and prevent it from carrying out a response that might worsen the conflict. Hamas, which is backed by Iran, welcomed the strike on Israel. Since launching its October 7 attack, Hamas had hoped that regional partners might come to its assistance and drag Israel into a broader war. While some have done that, including the Iranian-backed Hezbollah in Lebanon and Yemen's Houthis, Iran had not directly entered the fray until Sunday. Hamas could hope that the attack is the first salvo in deeper Iranian engagement in the war in Gaza. It also could hope that violence in the West Bank, where an Israeli teen was killed and settlers rampaged in Palestinian towns, continues to heat up. At the very least, Iran's attack may have emboldened Hamas to dig in its heels in current negotiations over a ceasefire, hoping the increased military pressure on Israel might lead it to accept the militant group's harder line terms for a deal. Continuing on page 2, written by Sergio Parakh P-A-R-E-K-H of KFF Health News. Headline reads, attacks on ER workers prompt debate. It says, patients hurl verbal abuse at Michelle Rivera every day in the emergency room. Physical violence is less common, she said, but is a growing threat. Rivera, an ER nurse at Sutter Medical Center in Sacramento, recalled an incident in which an agitated patient wanted to leave. Without any warning, he just reached up, grabbed my glasses, and punched me in the face, said Rivera, 54. And then he was getting ready to attack another patient in the room. Rivera and hospital security guards subdued the patient so he couldn't hurt anyone else. Violence against healthcare workers is on the rise, including in the ER, where tensions can run high as staff juggle multiple urgent tasks. The COVID-19 pandemic only made things worse. With routine care harder to come by, many patients ended up in the ER with serious diseases and brimming with frustrations. In California, simple assault against workers in an ER is considered the same as simple assault against almost anyone else and carries a maximum punishment of a $1,000 fine and 6 months in jail. In contrast, simple assault against emergency medical workers in the field, such as an EMT responding to a 911 call, carries maximum penalties of a $2,000 fine and a year in jail. Simple assault does not involve the use of a deadly weapon or the intention to inflict serious bodily injury. State Assembly member Fred D. Rodriguez, who worked as an EMT, authored a bill to make the punishments consistent, a $2,000 fine and 1 year in jail for simple assault on any on-the-job emergency healthcare worker, whether in the field or an ER. The measure also would eliminate the discrepancy for simple battery. Patients and family members are assaulting staff and doing things they shouldn't be doing to the people that are there to take care of your loved ones, said Rodriguez, a Democrat from Pomona. The bill passed the state assembly unanimously in January and awaits consideration in the Senate. Rodriguez introduced similar measures twice before. Then Governor Jerry Brown vetoed one in 2015, saying he doubted a longer jail sentence would deter violence. We need to find more creative ways to protect the safety of these critical workers, he wrote in his veto message. The 2019 bill died in the state Senate. Rodriguez said ERs have become more dangerous for healthcare workers since then, and there has to be, end quote, there has to be accountability for violent behavior, end quote. Opponents fear stiffer penalties would be levied disproportionately on patients of color or those with developmental disabilities. They also point out that violent patients can already face penalties under existing assault and battery laws. Data from the California Division of Occupational Safety and Health shows that reported attacks on ER workers by patients, visitors, and strangers jumped about 25% from 2018 to 2023, from 2,587 to 3,238. The rate of attacks per 100,000 ER visits also increased. Punching, kicking, pushing, and similar aggression accounted for most of the attacks. Only a small number included weapons. These numbers are likely an undercount, said Alea Alvarez, an ER doctor and clinical associate professor at Stanford University's Department of Emergency Medicine. Many hospital staffers don't fill out workplace violence reports because they don't have time or feel nothing will come of it, he said. Violence can contribute to burnout and drive workers to quit, or worse, said Alvarez, who lost colleagues to suicide and thinks burnout was a key factor. The cost of burnout is more than just loss of productivity, he said. It's loss of human beings that also had the potential to take care of many more people. Excuse me. The National Center for Health Workforce Analysis projects California will experience an 18% shortage of all types of nurses in 2035, the third worst in the country. Federal legislation called the Safety from Violence for Healthcare Employees Act would set sentences of up to 10 years for assault against a healthcare worker, not limited to emergency workers, and up to 20 years in cases involving dangerous weapons or bodily injury. Introduced in 2023, it has not yet had a committee hearing. Opponents of the California bill, which include ACLU, California Action, the California Public Defenders Association, and advocates for people with autism, argue that it wouldn't deter attacks and would unfairly target certain patients. Beth Burt, executive director of the Autism Society Inland Empire, said the measure doesn't take into account the special needs of people with autism and other developmental disorders. The smells, lights, textures, and crowds in an ER can overstimulate a person with autism, she said. They can struggle to articulate their feelings, which can result in a violent outburst, whether it's a 9-year-old or a 29-year-old, Burt said. She worries hospital staff may misunderstand these reactions and involve law enforcement when it's not necessary. As a patient, it is still my worst fear that she'll get a phone call to inform her that her adult son, I'm sorry, as a parent, it is still my worst fear, she said, that she'd get a phone call to inform her that her adult son with autism has been arrested. Burt would rather the state prioritize de-escalation programs over penalties, such as the training programs for first responders she helped create through the Autism Society Inland Empire. After implementing the training, hospital administrators asked Burt to share some strategies with them, she said. Hospital security staffers who do not want to use physical restraints on autistic patients also sought her advice. Here are some national, shorter, briefly headlines. Girl 8 fatally shot at gathering in Chicago. 11 people standing outside a family gathering Saturday night were shot, including a young girl who was killed in what Chicago police believe was gang-related violence on the city's south side. 4 victims were children, police said Sunday. An 8-year-old girl was fatally shot, while a 1-year-old boy and an 8-year-old boy were each shot multiple times and listed in critical condition. A 9-year-old boy was also injured with a grazed wound to his finger and hospitalized. The department's Sunday statement updated the number of shooting victims to 11 from 8 and gave new ages for the victims compared with the news conference late Saturday. No one was in custody Sunday. Presidential debates. 12 news organizations on Sunday urged presumptive presidential nominees Joe Biden and Donald Trump to agree to debates, saying they were a rich tradition that has been part of every general election campaign since 1976. Dateline, Oklahoma. 4 people were arrested and charged with murder and kidnapping over the weekend in connection with the disappearances of 2 Kansas women who were driving through Oklahoma. Vernon Butler, 27, and Jillian Kelly, 39. Their vehicle was found abandoned on a rural highway in Oklahoma. The wife of a former Harvard Medical School morgue manager, Denise Lodge, 64, of Goffston, New Hampshire, pleaded guilty Friday to a federal charge after investigators said she shipped stolen human body parts to buyers. And a pilot flying solo and using a backpack-style paramotor device died Sunday when the small aircraft crashed in the city of Maricopa, Arizona, authorities said. City spokesman said the crash occurred about 7 a.m. And House Speaker is to push for national security package, written by Stephen Groves. This is an Associated Press article. Dateline is Washington. House Speaker Mike Johnson said Sunday he will try to advance wartime aid for Israel this week as he attempts the difficult task of winning House approval for a national security package that includes funding for Ukraine and allies in Asia. Johnson, Republican Louisiana, is already under immense political pressure from his fellow GOP lawmakers as he tries to stretch between the Republican Party's divided support for helping Kyiv defend itself from Moscow's invasion. The Republican speaker has sat for 2 months on a $95 billion supplemental package that would send support to the U.S. allies, as well as provide humanitarian aid for civilians in Ukraine and Gaza, and funding to replenish U.S. weapons provided to Taiwan. The unprecedented attack by Iran on Israel early Sunday further ratcheted up the pressure on Johnson, but also gave him an opportunity to underscore the urgency of approving the funding. Johnson told Fox News Channel's Sunday Morning Futures that he and Republicans understand the necessity of standing with Israel, and he would try this week to advance the aid. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer at a news conference also said that President Biden held a phone call Sunday with the top Republicans and Democrats in the House and Senate, including Johnson. The New York Democrat said there was consensus among all the leaders that he had to help Israel and help Ukraine. And now, hopefully, we can work that out and get this done next week. All right, we got a little time for sports. Going to turn to that right now. And Great Scotty is the headline on this one again. It's golf, the Masters, Augusta, Georgia. Scotty Scheffler spent more time looking at his feet than any of the white leaderboards at Augusta National, all of them showing what everyone was watching, a Masters champion again, the undisputed best player in golf. He prefers to stay in his own little world, population one. Nobody's close to him in the game at the moment. Scheffler is number one in the world by a margin not seen since Tiger Woods in his prime. In 9 tournaments this year, he doesn't have a round over par and has earned over $15 million. And on Sunday, he delivered the greatest piece of evidence when he slipped into that green jacket. Scheffler pulled ahead with magnificent shots around the turn, poured it on along the back nine as his challengers melted away with mistakes, and closed with a 4-under 68 to claim his second Masters in 3 years with a 4-shot victory. And turning to NASCAR, Elliott wins Lone Star State Shootout. Victory ends 42-race winless streak on NASCAR Cup Circuit. And it reads here, from Fort Worth, Texas, Chase Elliott had to get through a few extra laps after 18 months since last winning a race. Elliott pulled ahead and cleared Ross Chastain on the first lap after the second restart in overtime Sunday at Texas Motor Speedway, ending a 42-race winless streak for NASCAR's most popular driver. A lot of things went on our way today. I'm not naive to that, Elliott said. You have to be in the mix, and you've got to be up front to even have things go your way. And we were close enough to do that. And before we wrap it up here, on April 15 in 1912, the British luxury liner RMS Titanic foundered in the North Atlantic off Newfoundland for more than 2.5 hours after hitting an iceberg. 1,514 people died, while less than half as many survived. So you are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we're going to turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger paper for April 15, Monday, 2024. And the headline here, one of the headlines, Sex Trafficking Issue Strikes Close to Home. Documentary, Trafficking Happens in All States and All Types of Communities. This is written by John McBride. And it reads, it can happen here. It is happening here. That was the most important message out of many that came from the town hall meeting Saturday at the Larimar Ballroom focusing on human trafficking. The event set up by the Safe Communities Coalition drew about 100 people. It began with a 50-minute documentary by a native Iowan and concluded with a question-and-answer session. The documentary, Grid Shock was produced by Vanessa McNeil, a survivor of sexual violence. It focuses on three women who are survivors of trafficking and how they were manipulated by people in their lives and not by outsiders. It also emphasizes how sex trafficking is happening in small towns across Iowa, not just bigger communities. The film also delves into how law enforcement struggles to deal with the problem and touches on those who are on the other side of the issue, people paying money for individuals that have been trafficked. "We are happy with the turnout," said Jeanette Potter, Safe Communities Coordinator of the Safe Communities Coalition. "It's probably a little more than we expected. We were a little disappointed we didn't get a younger demographic, but who we had here is great. We are just so grateful for the community support," she said. Randy Kuhlman, Chief Executive Officer of the Fort Dodge Community Foundation and United Way, said human trafficking is a scourge that negatively impacts people. He said he hoped people would come and learn about the topic, which they may not know a lot about. "A majority of criminal activity in human trafficking goes unreported. The victims are trying to extricate themselves from the power imbalance and fear being arrested for prostitution if they contact law enforcement officials." Kuhlman said Gridshock is a great way to frame the trafficking topic for people. McNeil, on her website, notes that while she's proud of the documentary, it is a difficult topic and can trigger some people as they hear the firsthand details of sex trafficking survivors from Iowa. Kuhlman warned those in attendance that the documentary could be difficult for some to watch and encouraged anyone that felt the need to step out of the viewing area to do so. The question and answer session was led by Ray Fiedler, coordinator for the State Office to Combat Human Trafficking, and two counselors who work with victims and survivors. One was Judy Wilson, who serves Webster County as the domestic violence abuse advocate through Crisis Intervention Services, along with Amber Lawrence, who has been involved in the fight against human trafficking since 2010. She is currently a licensed mental health therapist for teenagers. Kuhlman said the trio has a hands-on perspective that comes from working with those who have been trafficked. "People may erroneously think sex trafficking only takes place in large cities. However, according to the Blue Campaign, a national public awareness campaign devoted to preventing human trafficking, it is a problem everywhere, in all 50 states, including rural communities. According to a report by the Iowa Office to Combat Human Trafficking, there were 71 human trafficking tips and leads received by the agency in 2023. Law enforcement authorities believe, rather report, that trafficking victims are often teenage girls and young women. Young men are also victimized by self-traffickers, with LGBTQ people particularly vulnerable. The traffickers often aim for people on the margins of society, since those who are poor, are runaways, or who have mental health or substance abuse issues can be vulnerable to control. We can't fix a problem that we don't want to acknowledge, so I think it's important, so important, to get these types of things out there just for awareness," said Potter. "That was part of the reason that I wanted to hold this here and have local people sitting on the panel so that people can see they are working with victims and survivors here in our town. According to information given to those in attendance, less than 1% of sex trafficking in the United States is stranger abduction. Most victims are trafficked by someone they know and trust. In 2021, Iowa received 9 trafficking reports per 100,000 people. If only 1% of survivors are identified, then an estimated 8,600 people in Iowa are victims of human trafficking each year. Both the documentary and the panelists agreed that demand is one factor that drives trafficking. If there was one seeking to purchase individuals, the industry would not exist." Say that again. If there was no one seeking to purchase individuals, the industry would not exist. However, both the documentary and the panelist agreed that it is a huge obstacle to overcome. Several attendees submitted questions for the panel, and a lot of focused on funding at the state level to combat trafficking. Fiedler said in a perfect world there would be funding that allowed agencies to focus solely on trafficking, but he admitted at current funding levels that's not possible. I would like lawmakers to know that even small towns need help with this, said Potter. Small communities are in need of help and assistance more and more. Another article on the front page of the Messenger, headline is 75 Years a Legionnaire. Hans Madsen wrote this. Duncombe veteran recognized Sunday for years of service. The current American Legion Post 491 commander, Tom Powers, has an important date almost in common with Post Financial Officer Harold Andy Anderson. He joined on March 15, 1949, Powers said. I was born on March 16 of the same year. He joined the American Legion the day before I was born. That makes Powers 75, and it also makes Anderson a member in good standing for the same 7.5 decades. On Sunday, in the Duncombe Community Center, fellow Legion members, family, and friends gathered to see Anderson receive an award to recognize his 75 years of service. Anderson was drafted into the U.S. Army in 1948. He was discharged after a year then called back in 1950 to serve a year in Korea with an artillery unit. He was discharged in 1952. He was post commander for a year, although he could not recall the year. It's been a long time ago, he's joked. Anderson has spent many of his years of service as the post treasurer. Let me go to the next page here. Or financial officer. Andy has been an officer since I can remember, Powers said. He's very, very good. When I've double-checked, it's always right to the penny. Powers has many fond memories of time with Anderson that go back to his childhood. Anderson often took him along to go stock car racing. I was his mascot, Powers joked. He was never beaten. He was undefeated in Dayton. Anderson had a signature racing style. He was as laid back as they came, Powers said. He won every time trial. And he would lead the cars, just go along at 10 miles per hour. Everyone learned what happened next. Never drop a green flag in front of Harold Anderson. He was like the Tasmanian devil. Then when the checkered flag dropped, it was right back to 10 miles per hour. Then he would drive back to the pits and sit in a lawn chair with a big grin on his face. Mary Pringle of Otho came along to help celebrate with Anderson. Andy was a hell of a racer, Pringle said. My dad did race him. We watched him when we were little. Harold's first race, I was only a year old. American Legion State Commander Stanley Elliott was on hand for the celebration. I've been a member for 37 years, Elliott said. I can count on one hand the number of members I've seen with this many years of service. I just hope that when I'm 75 years old that I can get around like he does. Anderson's last vocation, before retirement was farming. He also worked as a mechanic. He's still an active member at 98. I still fire the rifle, he said. The secret to a long life and long membership in the American Legion? Stay active, Anderson said. Also, eat three meals a day. Here's an article. The heading reads, 4 people charged in the case of 2 missing women. It's on page 2 of the Messenger. Dateline is Oklahoma. 4 people were arrested and charged with murder and kidnapping over the weekend in connection with the disappearance of 2 Oklahoma women, Veronica Butler, 27, and Jillian Kelly, 39, of Hugoton, Kansas, were driving through the Oklahoma Panhandle to pick up Butler's children for a March 30 birthday party in Kansas, but never showed up. Their vehicle was later found abandoned on a rural highway in Texas County, Oklahoma, about 11 miles south of Elkhart, Kansas, on the Oklahoma-Kansas state line. The area is about 260 miles northwest of Oklahoma City. The Texas County Sheriff's Office requested help from the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigations, which said its officers immediately suspected foul play based on undisclosed evidence found in the vehicle. On Saturday, Oklahoma authorities said they arrested and charged four people, Ted Burt Colum, 43, Tiffany Mackle Adams, 54, and Cole Earl Twombly, 50, and Corana Twombly, 44. All four were charged with two counts of first-degree murder, two counts of kidnapping, and one count of conspiracy to commit murder in the first degree. Authorities are still searching for the victims, Oklahoma investigators said in their statement. Turning to opinion page, a couple here. This one is entitled, "There's No Such Thing as Canceling Student Loan Debt." Randy Feenstra is the writer of this. Republican Hall represents Iowa's 4th Congressional District. Personal responsibility and accountability are virtues fundamental to any functioning society. Everyone makes decisions based on different goals and aspirations, and we are all ultimately responsible for the choices that we make. Yet contrary to common sense, President Biden has decided that people who sign paperwork to take out student loans and have a legal and financial obligation to repay them are entitled to debt forgiveness at the expense of American taxpayers. As a result, the Biden administration has, to date, forgiven roughly $146 billion in student loan debt. This is not only an insult to Americans nationwide who responsibly pay their own bills and work hard to make an honest living, but also disastrous for our worsening fiscal health. Last summer, in a ruling that protected taxpayers, the U.S. Supreme Court found that President Biden's first attempt to cancel around $400 billion in student loans was unconstitutional. However, this decision hasn't stopped the Biden administration from moving forward with its brazen student loan forgiveness schemes. In fact, it seems to have emboldened the president. Just a few months after the Supreme Court's clear ruling, President Biden rolled out his so-called SAVE in caps, that is in caps, SAVE plan, another taxpayer-funded effort that would cost approximately $559 billion. Iowans who never attended college, entered the workforce early, or helped put their kids through school should not be forced to pick up the tab for President Biden's costly and unfair student loan bailout. That's why I voted to overturn this radical initiative to saddle American families with additional expenses as inflation and sky-high interest rates crush their budgets and purchasing power. People still have to pay off their car loans and credit card bills. Student loans are no different. Now, President Biden is doubling down on his failed proposals and calling for another round of student loan bailouts without any accountability or oversight. Instead of helping students understand the cost of college and make responsible financial decisions, President Biden is perfectly comfortable with extracting taxpayer dollars from the 87% of Americans without student loan debt to subsidize the 13% who chose to attend college. If student loans and their accompanying interest payments can simply be erased, people who have already paid off their debts are punished for their frugality and responsibility. That's just wrong. While President Biden fails to offer real solutions to the affordability crisis that his reckless spending policies created, I have introduced legislation to help our kids pursue an education. Current law does not require the disclosure of the total interest amount that a student loan applicant would pay based on the applicable repayment plan. As a result, many students are not aware of the actual amount they will end up paying over the life of a loan. To rectify this lack of transparency, my Student Act, which I'm leading alongside Senator Ernst, would provide student loan applications with an estimate of the total amount of interest they would pay based on a standard 10-year repayment plan during or prior to accepting a loan. When students consider the total cost of a college degree, interest payments on student loans should be a transparent component of their financial calculations. By equipping students and their families with the information that they need to make sound financial decisions, we can ensure that young people receive a quality education and avoid mountains of debt when they enter the workforce. Our nation is nearly $35 trillion in debt. We can't afford to add hundreds of billions of dollars to our credit card when our families are already struggling from record inflation and government waste. As a strong fiscal conservative, I will continue to oppose President Biden's unconstitutional student loan forgiveness plans, stand up for hardworking Iowa taxpayers, and help our kids get a degree if they so choose. Again, U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra, Republican Hall, represents Iowa's 4th Congressional District. And here's an article by Armstrong Williams, The Lesson for Gun Owners in the James and Jennifer Crumbly Convictions. This is his opinion. The convictions of James Crumbly and his wife Jennifer for their role in their son's mass school shooting in Michigan, which resulted in the tragic murders of 4 and injuries of 7, tells us one thing. If you are an irresponsible gun owner, you will pay the price if a crime is committed with your gun. It is as simple as that. Lock your gun up, keep it away from your children, and if you have a mentally unwell child, keep an even more watchful eye on your firearm. This was not done in the Crumbly's case. The safety of our nation and our schools depends on responsible gun owners during the night doing the right thing and keeping their guns out of the hands of their children. There are far too many mass school shootings because there are far too many mentally unwell patients, unwell students, and far too many parents who are careless with their firearms. This is a precedent-setting case, the first time the parents of a school mass shooter have been charged, but the clear negligence displayed by the Crumblies went beyond the failure to secure the firearms. It was their clear and profound lapse in judgment, despite clear warning, signs that their child was troubled. They may not have given their child the firearms and said to go and commit a heinous crime, but not taking the necessary steps to secure the firearm or get their son the help he clearly, evidently needed, makes them culpable for his actions, which could have been easily avoided if they had acted differently. It's very possible that lives could have been saved were it not for parents who made excuses to excuse their son's troubling behavior, even though the school took clear steps, including talking to the parents about their child. The Crumblies missed an opportunity to intervene and potentially prevent a catastrophe. When a child under the care of adults displays serious mental health issues, those warning signs must not be ignored. Proactive steps and measures should be taken to get that child help that they need to avoid them harming not only their other people, but even themselves. Mental health is a serious problem, but with help, you can often save someone. Ignoring the glaring signs of their children's mental distress while knowing he had access to a weapon in their home certainly makes the Crumblies liable. It is not enough to react to warning signs without taking proactive measures. Mental health issues require serious attention, understanding, and action within not just families, but also educational institutions, healthcare systems, and through legislative measures. The Crumblies' oversight is a tragic example of what happens when mental distress signs are ignored or minimized, especially when combined with access to weapons. The convictions of James and Jennifer Crumbly should set a precedent for parents who ignore the warning signs of their child's troubling behavior and the responsibility to seek help. It also serves as a sobering reminder of the responsibility that comes with gun ownership and the safe storage of guns around children. I'm a strong believer in the Second Amendment and do not believe the government should encroach on Americans' constitutionally protected right to keep and bear arms. However, I also believe we must respect the responsibility that comes with this right. We have seen too many young people commit heinous crimes, smash and grabs, armed robberies in inner cities, kids in the suburbs shooting and killing their classmates. And one question I've always asked is, where are the parents? We cannot continue to allow parents to allow their reckless and troubled children to wreak havoc on the rest of society without any consequences. The trials and convictions of the Crumblies should serve as a reminder for anyone out there with a troubled child and firearms in the home. Get your child the help they need and secure those firearms for the safety of you, your child, and those around them. Moving over to the obituaries now. We have 5 or 6 here. Kenneth Cervine, Cervine, 91, a Badger, died January 15, 2024 at the Marion Home A service honoring Kenneth's life will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 20th at First Covenant Church. Interment will follow at the Dayton Cemetery with military honors presented by VFW Post number 1856. Family will greet friends from 10 a.m. to 10:45 a.m. Saturday, April 20th at the church. Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services entrusted with the arrangements. There's one for Thomas Simmons, North Liberty. Simons, S-I-M-O-N-S, 85, died peacefully Tuesday, April 2, at the Veteran Medical Center in Iowa City. Services will be held at a later date in Fort Dodge. Memorials may be directed, to the charities that Tom supported. And Tom was born January 29, 1939, in Carroll, son of Aloysius and Louise Vetiker Simons. He was a graduate of St. Edmunds High School in Fort Dodge. He was proud to serve his country, United States Air Force. And on February 2 of 74, Tom married the love of his life, Arlene Habern, in Fort Dodge. Here's Richard Kraft, 85, of Fort Dodge, died Wednesday, April 10, at the Paula Baber Hospice Home. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 20, at the historic Bruce Funeral Home, 923 First Avenue South, with Reverend Gary Snook officiating. Military honors will be conducted by the VFW Post 1856 and the U.S. Army Honor Guard, and interment will take place at Corpus Christi Cemetery at a later date. Arrangements are with Historic Bruce Funeral Home of Fort Dodge. To view the complete obituary, you can leave online condolences for the family. Please visit brucesfuneralhome.com. Dolores D. Peterson, P-E-D-E-R-S-O-N, age 99, of Rolfe, passed away Tuesday, January 2 of 24, at the Palo Alto County Health System in Emmitsburg, Iowa. Memorial service is 10:30 a.m. Friday the 19th at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Rolfe, with Pastor Don Bell and Reverend Mark Howland officiating. Burial will be in Clinton Garfield Cemetery near Rolfe. And Matthew Eslick, Eagan, Minnesota, 44 years old and formerly of Dayton, Iowa, passed away on Tuesday, April 9 at Regions Hospital in St. Paul, Minnesota. Celebration of life service for Matthew will be held 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 20, at the United Methodist Church in Dayton. Steve Satter will officiate. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday, April 19, also at United Methodist Church. And finally, there is one here for Russell Williams, 64, of Fort Dodge, passed away Saturday, April 13th at his home. Services are pending with Losweiler Funeral Home. Going to jump to the sports section now. And here's an article. Its headline is Clark Makes TV Appearance, written by Doug Feinberg, AP basketball writer. Dateline is New York. Live from New York, it's Caitlin Clark. The Iowa star made a surprise appearance on Saturday Night Live during the show's Weekend Update segment. She said she first heard about the possibility at the Final Four, although discussions had been ongoing for a couple of weeks. "I didn't know the script until I showed up and saw it and was like, this is very good," Clark told the AP on Sunday. Set them straight about women's sports was pretty phenomenal. The crowd was great. Way more nervous than I get for a basketball game. A bucket list item. The Iowa star is in New York for the WNBA draft on Monday night, when she is expected to be the top pick by the Indiana Fever. The NCAA Division I all-time leading scorer showed up after anchor Michael Shea made a joke about Iowa returning her jersey. And Clark got the last laugh. She got the last laugh as Che then read some jokes that Clark said she wrote that made fun of the comedian. "A lot of cast members came up to me and were so excited I was there, and they said they always watched this," Clark said. "Because they pushed me on their chair, my heart was beating through my chest." The Iowa native then delivered a heartfelt message about her basketball future, thanking many of the great players who came before her. "I'm sure it will be a big first step for me, but it's just one step for the WNBA, thanks to all the great players like Cheryl Swoops, Lisa Leslie, Cynthia Cooper, the great Don Staley, and my basketball hero, Maya Moore, Clark said. These are the women that kicked down the door so I could walk inside, so I want to thank them right tonight. I want to thank them tonight for laying the foundation. Clark came back on stage at the end of the show, bringing her former Hawkeye teammates Kate Martin, Gabby Marshall, and Jada Giamaffi with her. It's so cool. They got into New York City yesterday, Clark said of her teammates. The producer asked if they wanted to go up on stage at the end. They got a little shell-shocked at first, but it's cool that I could share these moments with them. Clark watched the first half of the show from the dressing room so as to not spoil the surprise for the fans. She got to see musical guest Chris Stapleton's second performance from on the set after her appearance. It's been a busy week for Clark since her team lost to South Carolina in the national championship game in Cleveland. She went to Los Angeles to accept the John R. Wooden Award, had a rally at the Iowa Arena to celebrate the team, and now is in New York. And one other article, just briefly mentioned, it's on the front page with of the sports section with Caitlin. It's called Green Me Up, Scotty. Green Me Up, Scotty. Scheffler dominates on way to second green jacket. Augusta, Georgia, spent more time looking at his feet than any of the white leaderboards at Augusta National, all of them showing what everyone was watching. A Masters champion again, the undisputed best player in golf. He prefers to stay in his own little world, population one. And he won the Masters. So that, folks, that brings us to the end. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe-Gazette. I'm your reader, Doug Kretzinger. I want to thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, and I wish you a great day.